From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, a look at service, like the service of a group of U.S. citizens who are often forgotten.
In every village on Guam, you're going to find a big amount of people who served in the military in some capacity. It's a family tradition to do it.
And what happens when medical services are in short supply?
If you are Hispanic in the United States, you're less likely to be diagnosed with autism. If you are Hispanic in southwestern Pennsylvania, you're even less likely to be diagnosed with autism.
Plus, the unsung veterans of Puerto Rico. And we meet a woman who identifies migrants who died on their journey and helps their families heal. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, what does it mean to serve? And what does it mean to lack services? We start today's show in what might seem like an unlikely place, the island of Guam, a U.S. territory in the Pacific Ocean, 6,000 miles from California. Now, Guam isn't a place we cover very often here at Latino USA, but the island's native people, the Chamorros, share much of the Latino experience. You don't believe me? Well, this is how you count to 10 in the Chamorro language.
Uno, dos, tres, cuatro, cinco, seis, siete, ocho, nueve, diez.
Guam was once colonized by Spain. So, many people in Guam have Spanish names, and there are Spanish loan words in the Chamorro language. Chamorros are Catholic, and they eat corn tatillas, which are like tortillas. So we do have a connection to Guam. The roughly 200,000 people who live on the island, which is an unincorporated territory, are American citizens. And even though they can't vote for president, they can serve in the U.S. military. And they do, in surprising numbers. The highest rate, in fact, of the United States. At least one in eight adult Guamanians is a veteran. I recently visited Guam to find out why so many of the island's people have chosen to become warriors for a country half a world away, even as some say they get much too little in return. I arrived in Guam just in time for Liberation Day. Every July 21st, Guam celebrates the American liberation of the island from the Japanese during World War II with a huge throw-out-all-the-stops parade. One after another, blocks-long contingents of Guamanian American soldiers march.
You know, Guam is very traditional when it comes to the military.
That's Sergeant First Class Gonzalo Fernandez, a recruiter for the National Guard.
In every village on Guam, you're going to find a big amount of people who served in the military in some capacity. It's a family tradition to do it.
That tradition makes it an easy place to get people to sign up. In fact, Fernandez has won the Guard's Recruiter of the Year award 3 times in a row.
The success I have here, I probably couldn't duplicate anywhere else because I'm not sure that the people of those places are as patriotic as the people on this island.
In fact, Guamanians serve at a rate 3 times higher than the rest of the country. Part of it may have to do with the military's massive presence on the island. Guam is known as the tip of the spear in the Pacific. 30% of the island is occupied by military bases.
If you look there, you can see that's the port of Guam. And right over there, you've got U.S. Navy Base Guam, one of the several U.S. military installations on Guam.
University of Guam history professor Michael Bivacqua took me to see where the American Marines landed in Guam in 1944.
When you look at Guam today, you may not sort of ever imagine that just 2 generations ago it was a battlefield. But if you look, you can still see scars everywhere. You can see them in the landscape. You can see them on the people, in the stories that people tell, in the identities that they feel.
One of those scars, Bavakwa says, is its unequal relationship with the United States.
Some people say, oh, Guam, wow, Central America. Guam, really, you look so light for an African. This is a hard fact that a lot of people, when they go to the States, they realize is that you may have spent your whole life dreaming about the United States, thinking about how cool it is and how you're a big part of it. But then when you go there, you find that people don't know anything about you and they don't care about you.
So if you translate that sense of invisibility to what's happening in terms of Guamanians and Pacific Islanders and their military service.
Let's say you live your whole life on Guam and then you feel this sort of rejection from the United States. I really think that it does have this problem of, you know, people feeling like they're shut out of America, and so some people join to try and prove that they're really a part of the United States.
Is that what it's about?
No, that's part of it, though. But in truth, a lot of it has to do with the shininess and the niceness of the military. You know, and just there's all this excess of, it seems like there's this excess of resources.
Nearly a quarter of Guam's population lives in poverty. So for many Guamanians, the military is a way out. But whatever their reasons may be for joining, coming home after serving presents soldiers with a whole new set of challenges. Pacific Islanders not only serve at the highest rates, they are injured and die at the highest rates too. But Guam ranked dead last in medical care spending per veteran by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs in 2012. In recent years, many servicemen and women have been returning from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with physical and psychological scars. And many say they have trouble obtaining the care they need.
This is where the IED went off.
One of those vets is Roland Atta, a 34-year-old who served two tours in Iraq as a combat medic. In his home on Guam, he showed me pictures of a roadside bombing he witnessed in which several Iraqi men and children were killed.
This kid here was, he was on fire when we rolled up. He was already dead when we got there.
Today, Roland suffers from severe post-traumatic stress disorder because of experiences such as these.
Those photographs of dead children.
Mm-hmm. I still see them every once in a while. That's why I get drunk, so I don't have to see them. Or if I get drunk, or it numbs everything for me.
Some days, he says, he feels incapable of even leaving the house. He says he has frequent thoughts of suicide. The first time was towards the end of his active service, while he was on base in Hawaii.
I was mad at the world. I was mad at everybody. I was mad at myself. And that's what scares me, is when I do get mad, is stuff like that. Those fleeting thoughts could become real. That's why I get scared of myself.
Because it's not just hurting yourself, but maybe
other people.
Roland wants to get better, but he says he's been unable to find the intensive PTSD treatment he needs here in Guam. In fact, the nearest VA program offered is in Hawaii, 8 hours away by plane.
Sometimes I think going back to the States, I'd have a better care, I guess you could say. And it sucks because this is my home. I want to be here. But I can't get the help that I need. It's not the help I want. It's the help I need.
The VA doesn't operate a hospital in Guam. It did, however, open a new clinic for veterans in 2011.
This is like a big doctor's office, is what this is. We don't do overnight stay. So
Craig Oswald is an official with the VA health system based in Hawaii. Because there were no official agency representatives in Guam, the VA flew him in to meet with me.
We've got a board-certified full-time psychiatrist, two of them, here on island.
Is that enough?
To treat veterans.
You feel like having two psychiatrists on the island to treat veterans, is that enough? Do you wish there was more?
I think right now we're doing well.
I pressed him on what I'd been hearing from veterans about a lack of services, and specifically what Roland had said about the treatment he needs for his PTSD.
He kind of feels like there's the services that he needs do not exist on the island where he lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you hear that, what goes on for you?
Well, we're very concerned about hearing that from veterans. We have been building a healthcare system here in the Pacific, particularly over the last 20 years, to try to meet what we call unmet demand. All I know is that in an area like the Pacific, We have grown tremendously our capabilities to help these people over the years, and we have future plans to go even further.
But not everybody would agree with Oswald's claims that things are getting better. Governor Eddie Calvo, the highest elected official on the island, told me that the U.S. Senate cut funds for mental health care for Guam vets 2 years in a row.
Unfortunately, some of the policymakers out there in Washington, D.C., they have a pretty cavalier attitude towards the citizenry out here in Guam. Of course, it doesn't help that we're an unincorporated territory that has no vote in a Congress or a Senate, or has no vote for a president. And with that, it makes it that much more difficult to getting our voices heard.
Is the United States right now living up to its commitment to Guam in terms of what it's doing for the veterans?
The federal government has not done their part to assist a very patriotic group of American citizens fighting in so many distant lands, fighting for the freedoms of folks in areas that have never tasted democracy, yet really have not felt what true democracy is all about. What do you call a people that cannot vote for their representatives that make the laws? To not offend anyone, I guess I'll keep it as a non-self-governing territory. But I guess in a 19th century sense, you could call it a colony.
For Governor Calvo, Guam's lack of federal representation is the biggest hurdle in securing further resources for the island's veterans. Until those resources arrive, vets like Roland Otta may have to either leave the island for care or learn to get by on their own and hope they make it out without hurting themselves or others. Roland knows his family is worried about him.
You know, every night when I go out to shoot pool or when I go out to go drink, I don't want them to have to worry that, is he going to make it home tonight? And the only thing that kind of snaps me back to reality is kind of like, I got to think of my family.
Since I saw Roland on Guam, he reached out pleading for help. But recently, he did begin treatment at a local vet center. Later, we'll be talking about the needs of vets from Puerto Rico, another island territory with a strong tradition of military service. Our report on Guam veterans is an adaptation of a story from my new PBS television series, America by the Numbers, with Maria Hinojosa. Our TV series is dedicated to reporting on the new mainstream, using data to tell the human stories behind the massive demographic change our country is living through. To watch the full 30-minute episode on Guam's wounded warriors, tune into your local PBS station or the World Channel, or visit us at pbs.org. Coming up on Latino USA.
And now they say they're blessed because they're able to lay flowers on her grave.
A new angle on a story about identifying migrants who die on their journey. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Don't you go anybody else, baby, 'cause I'm your
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. About 1.5% of American children have autism spectrum disorder. It's a developmental disorder characterized by atypical behavior and slow language learning. For Latinos, the problem starts with diagnosing autism. Poor medical access means the rate of diagnosis is lower for Latinos than it is for the general population. From Pittsburgh, Erica Barras reports.
Jorge and Adenia Bernal knew early on that something was different about their son, Jesus. There was the way he acted, constant hand flapping and excessive crying. He also wasn't learning to talk, not the Spanish they had grown up speaking in Mexico, and not the English spoken in Pittsburgh. When they took him to doctors, they heard this.
Quizás porque hablan dos idiomas. Ustedes hablan español y acá hablan inglés. Oye, inglés y español, está confundido, no sabe qué cosa es.
Por eso no hablaba, pero porque mi hija hablaba español y hablaba inglés y veíamos la diferencia porque mi hija es más pequeña que él.
The Bernals were young parents and hadn't mastered English or the American healthcare system, so they went with what the doctors told them, that because they spoke Spanish at home, Jesus's English wasn't developing.
No puedes decir que porque habla inglés o español quiere decir que no te va a hablar ninguna lengua. Tiene que hablar algo. Pero el problema es que no hablaba nada. Sí. Por eso nunca nos creímos pues lo que decía la gente.
They thought their child should have been speaking some language, and they didn't believe what they were told. After all, Jesus's younger sister was already adept at both languages, while Jesus was barely speaking either. Eventually, the Bernals found their way to Diego Chavez Henico, a pediatrician whose specialty is developmental behavior. He's originally from Colombia.
¿Cómo está? ¿Cómo está, Jesus?
That's Jesus, now 9 years old, greeting Dr. Diego in the waiting room of Salud para Niños, or Health for Children, the busy bilingual clinic he runs.
Buenos días, ¿cómo están? ¿Cómo les va? ¿Cómo les ha ido? ¿Cómo va todo? ¿Cómo está Lino? Hola, campeón.
As he makes the rounds, Dr. Diego greets his young patients with a hi, princess, hey, champion. It was Dr. Diego who diagnosed Jesus with autism. The prevalence of autism has risen dramatically in recent years. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that 1 in 68 children have it. But that's for the general population. Dr. Diego says those numbers don't reflect Latino numbers.
If you are Hispanic in the United States, you're less likely to be diagnosed with autism. If you are Hispanic in southwestern Pennsylvania, you're even less likely to be diagnosed with autism.
And when they are diagnosed, studies show it can be years later than their white counterparts. Why? The explanations are the same as for many health disparities. Latinos are more likely to live below the poverty line, but less likely to have health insurance or a family doctor. Here in Pittsburgh, where Latino communities are fairly new, the problems are exacerbated.
Even though we have made progress in terms of screening, assessing, diagnosing, referring and treating kids with autism, we're still not at the level that where we could be if we were, you know, in another part of the country where the population is more prevalent or where the population is more visible.
Dr. Diego says not being diagnosed early on can be detrimental. The earlier a child gets into early intervention services, the better the long-term outcome.
And a lot of the times I use myself as an example. I said, you know, the fact that I have an accent when I speak in English has to do with the fact that I didn't learn English when I was young enough. I learned my English when I was 10, 13 years old. If I had learned my English when I was 2 or 3 years old, I wouldn't have this accent. I missed that boat. We don't want our kids to miss that boat.
For years, his conclusions have been based on anecdotes. Families like the Bernals, whose children haven't been given diagnoses until they found their way to him or one of his colleagues. But in the last couple of years, university studies out of California, Oregon, and Texas, as well as data from the CDC, have backed up his work. Dr. Diego says awareness is also an issue.
I have conversations with families where I mention the word autism, and families have never heard this term. They have never heard the diagnosis.
Adenia Bernal hadn't.
Así es que preguntamos cómo íbamos a hacer, si había una cura, un medicamento, pero no. Era pura terapia, así es que nos concentramos en darle mucha terapia.
Adenia Bernal learned there was no medicine for autism, only therapy, mostly in speech and behavior. Although there's no known cause or cure, the Bernals wanted to do everything they could for their son. It wasn't easy. The family didn't own a car to get to daily appointments. Adenia became a stay-at-home mother to handle Jesus's care, which hurt the family financially. And not speaking English made it hard for her to communicate with therapists.
El único support que teníamos era entre ella y yo.
The only support they had, Jorge says, was each other. Jesus was diagnosed before age 3, and he's made great strides. He shakes my hand when I meet him, he's mainstreamed at school, and he's gone from services every day to a few afternoons a week. And when you speak to him, he speaks back.
You want to go play on the computer?
Yeah. No, yo no te voy a estar viendo.
Just wait a minute, okay?
I can watch him, Dad. I can look at.
Okay.
For Latino USA, I'm Erica Barris in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Now, my dear listeners, we want to take you back to last June when we talked with reporter Monica Ortiz Uribe, who works with the Fronteras Network. We learned about a mass grave of migrants, some of them children, that was located in Brooks County, Texas.
Take us to how this story actually breaks.
Well, so there has been an influx, an inundation of immigrants at the South Texas border, as we've heard reported for the last year, actually. And so these migrants, as they're coming further north, they try to skirt a Border Patrol checkpoint that is 70 miles north of the Texas border. These checkpoints are all across the border. And so to try and skirt this Border Patrol checkpoint, the migrants are crossing through this harsh ranch land. Much of it is privately owned, where it's hot, the conditions are very harsh, there's little shade, little water, and they have to contend with the elements. And some of them die in this very last leg of their journey. And so it falls on the county, it's called Brooks County, to deal with the deaths and to bury the migrants.
Of the hundreds of bodies that have been recovered, many remain unidentified, ending up in unmarked graves in small border town cemeteries. But Dr. Lori Baker, a forensic scientist at Baylor University in Texas, is trying to identify some of these remains to match them with families who are looking for their lost relatives. She recently sat down with StoryCorps, along with her husband, Eric Baker, to talk about the service she provides for families, strangers, and their loved ones. Just a warning now, this program contains content that might be upsetting for some listeners.
I went out on a forensic case, and the sheriff had a skull on his office desk. It was the skull of a younger person, and he was using it as a pencil holder. He had pens and pencils in the eye socket of this person. So that's when I decided something had to be done. Now what we do is we go to cemeteries along the border. Sometimes there are multiple individuals in any one grave. We found people in trash bags. And we work to determine who they are. We take DNA samples and go through reports that families have filed to find one little thing that might connect to the case that you're working on. When we have an identification, it's resolution. But the families are going to know the horrible things that happened to their loved one. They die of heat stroke. It's exposure. And it's really overwhelming when you're holding them in your hands. And you see the blisters that are on the feet of these individuals. I remember our very first identification. It was a woman. She had two young daughters, and she lived with her mom. She couldn't take care of them, so she decided to come to the U.S. so that she could work and send money home. So she paid someone to smuggle her across, and she twisted her ankle. and the group left her behind because she couldn't keep up. Well, her remains came to me, and when it was an identification, I thought, oh, I've got to find out from that mom if it would have been better just not to know, thinking maybe she lived and would come home someday. And she said, no, the hope eats you alive every day. And now they say they're blessed because they're able to lay flowers on her grave.
Has it gotten any easier?
It hasn't. I would love not to do this anymore, but I don't think I have it in me not to, especially when we have a 11-year-old child, and I know we probably won't figure out who he is, and his mom's probably grieving somewhere. It's really something that I don't know that I'll ever get over if we don't figure out who he is.
That's forensic scientist Lori Baker with her husband Eric Baker in Waco, Texas. Their interview will be archived in the Library of Congress. Thanks to our friends at StoryCorps. You can find their podcast on your favorite app and at npr.org. By the end of the year, it's estimated almost 75,000 unaccompanied minors from Central America and Mexico will have crossed the border. That figure comes from KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, a group that provides legal representation to these children. It's almost double the number from 2013. New York has received more of these children than any state except Texas. As Alexandra Starr reports, every Saturday afternoon in the Bronx, a group of these teens meet to play a sport they love.
A group of boys playing pickup soccer a few blocks from Yankee Stadium are celebrating a goal. Most of the players are from Honduras and crossed the border on their own. All of them were detained before being released to family members in New York City. They're still facing possible deportation, though. That's why we're using just their first names.
For me, soccer is everything.
Carlos is 18. He never misses a practice.
I like to come every Saturday because I focus so much I forget what's happening outside. I forget about problems, arguments. I just focus on soccer, which is what I like.
There's a lot that Carlos would like to forget. Some of it dates back to his childhood in San Pedro Sula in Honduras. It's the city with the highest murder rate in the Americas, according to a Mexican think tank. When Carlos was 15 years old, he saw a close friend shot in front of him by gang members. He was told the group did not allow for witnesses. He would either have to join their ranks or die.
Muy triste y dolorosa a la vez también.
It was very sad and painful at the same time, seeing your friends die. I didn't care if something happened to me, but to my family, because they seek vengeance with the family, not just with the person they target. So I had to come here.
Carlos set out north when he was 16 years old with just $150 on him. The trip through Guatemala, Mexico took him 7.5 months. That was mostly because he would stop and take odd jobs to save up money so he could pay for the bus. At first, he hitched rides on the freight train known as La Bestia. What he saw freaked him out.
I didn't have a guide to bring me. I made it by luck. I saw a lot of people fall from the trains, ended up mutilated. I think I saw people die like 10 times on the way over. I didn't want to be another one of those victims.
Carlos was eventually apprehended by Border Patrol in Arizona. After a month and a half in juvenile detention, he was released to his grandmother in the Bronx. He's being represented by an attorney at Catholic Charities. Brett Stark.
Many of my clients, I would say most, are pursuing something called special immigrant juvenile status, which is for children under the age of 21 who've been abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both of their parents. And it's something that many of the unaccompanied kids we're seeing are eligible for.
Carlos is eligible because his father abandoned the family when he was a baby. Catholic Charities isn't just providing pro bono legal help for him. Staff there hooked him up with a weekly soccer game. It's run by South Bronx United, a nonprofit tutoring and soccer program. Elvis Garcia Callejas understands what the players are grappling with. He himself came to the United States as an unaccompanied migrant from Honduras a decade ago.
The language is different, school system is different, people here are different.
He says soccer was a grounding force as he adjusted to a very different life in the States.
Coming to the U.S. and having soccer in this country, it makes them feel like they know something.
Garcia Callejas now works as a case manager at Catholic Charities. He also moonlights as Carlos's soccer coach. Carlos likes being around kids like him, kids who are also from Honduras, trying to make their way in an unfamiliar world.
I started talking to them, and we became friends. Through soccer, as I told you, because if we hadn't come here, hadn't started playing, we wouldn't have the friendships we've made, you know?
The boys are also contending with the stress of being in legal limbo. They are awaiting court hearings that will determine whether they can stay in the U.S. One of Carlos's teammates, Ariel, says he's pinning his hopes on it.
I give thanks to God. I hope that the judge will say yes, give me residency or citizenship so I can be someone here in the United States, continue with my soccer and get to a better place.
In a lot of ways, the boys' lives feel on hold until they find out whether they can stay for good. But one thing will be constant as they wait. Every Saturday afternoon, they'll be playing at the pickup game in the South Bronx. For Latino USA, I'm Alexandra Starr in New York.
Coming up on Latino USA.
General MacArthur has praised the Puerto Rican 65th Regiment for its valor during the bitter Korean campaign.
The story of the soldiers known as the Borinqueneers. Stay with us, no se vayan.
It's a miracle.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Earlier in our program, we heard about the situation of veterans from Guam. And while I was on the island of Guam, one of the things I heard over and over again from the people there was, we just wish we were Puerto Rico, because if we were Puerto Rico, then at least people would know where our island was. So we invited Puerto Rico's congressional delegate to the U.S. to tell us what it's like for that island's veterans in terms of health care, jobs, and the recent federal investigations into practices at the VA health system, along with some very specific findings about veterans in Puerto Rico. Joining us from San Juan is Congressman Pedro Pierluisi, Puerto Rico's resident commissioner. Congressman Pierluisi, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria, for inviting me to participate in your program.
So just so that we have a basic understanding, make it clear exactly what your role is.
I'm a member of Congress in the sense that I have all the rights, privileges of any member, except that I don't vote on the floor of the House. I represent more constituents than any other member of the U.S. House of Representatives. I represent today roughly 3.6 million American citizens living in Puerto Rico. So my job is not limited to being in the U.S. House, but rather I have to cover the Senate, the executive branch. In a way, I'm like an ambassador at large for all the American citizens living in Puerto Rico.
Paint a picture of the current situation for Puerto Rican veterans on the island. What exactly is their situation now?
We currently have over 100,000 American veterans registered for services in Puerto Rico, in the veterans health system for the Caribbean. But the unofficial number is that we probably have about 150,000 veterans living in Puerto Rico. The Veterans Administration spends roughly $500 million a year in its operations in Puerto Rico and in the U.S. Virgin Islands. We have one major hospital in San Juan and 10 outpatient clinics throughout the island and the VI. But there are some deficiencies in terms of the medical care that our veterans get in Puerto Rico, and deficiencies in terms of the health insurance that military personnel and military retirees get in Puerto Rico. Let me be specific. I, for one, I have been complaining that I'm concerned about the number of mental health professionals serving in our Veterans Administration facilities in Puerto Rico. The rate of suicide attempts in Puerto Rico is too high, much higher than in the mainland. So I am complaining about that.
In April of this year, of course, a huge scandal broke out when it was discovered that at least 40 veterans had died while they waited for health care in Phoenix, Arizona's Veterans Health Administration facility. So now, what do we know in terms of federal probes in Puerto Rico's VA health system? What has been uncovered?
No, the Inspector General has done some probes in Puerto Rico and was very critical of the way that claims are being handled in Puerto Rico. I'm talking about disability claims, for example. The Inspector General said that it's taking too long to handle the claims, that the rate of inaccuracy in the determinations is too high. So that's another angle that I have been pursuing.
So in July, CNN reported that an internal Veterans Affairs audit found that appointment schedulers for veteran health services in San Juan, that the schedulers were actually keeping outside logs in order to hide the long delays. So what do you know about that, Congressman?
Yeah, what I know about it is that, for example, when scheduling appointments in the electronic records, they would simply tell the veteran the next available appointment is, and then they would give a date, which could be a month later, right? And then, but they would when registering this case, they would say that that's actually what the veteran requested, when in fact the veteran was requesting a more expedited handling. of his or her case. And I understand that measures have been taken or are in the process of being taken, so that doesn't continue to happen.
There was also some disturbing news that was reported in June. A federal agency that protects whistleblowers in the federal government found allegations that the nursing staff at the VA center in San Juan had actually neglected elderly residents by failing to provide services, basic services like bathing and food. So have you been following this probe, and what is the latest?
Yes, I raised, my office has gotten a lot of queries and complaints from the veterans community. And I met recently with VA's director of the region, as well as the head of the Veterans Administration Caribbean Health System in Puerto Rico, and I gave them a whole list of the complaints I have received, which include what you just mentioned. So I was giving them the whole list, but at the same time protecting the identity of the people who have, or the veterans, as well as veteran administration personnel, who have been raising these issues with my office.
Congressman, I wonder your reaction to this statement that I have heard, that I heard actually over and over again when I was on Guam. Many Guamanians, veterans or not veterans, said to me, oh my God, we just wish we were Puerto Rico.
The same happens with Puerto Rico. We're just closer to the mainland. We're a lot more, remember. That's the difference. It's a difference of sheer numbers. Puerto Rico can definitely aspire to become a state. In the case of smaller territories, I think the situation is a bit different. But perhaps we can find a way in which the territories also have some kind of representation in Congress with a vote. In the case of Puerto Rico, because of our size, it would be what I said a while ago. It should be 2 senators and 5 reps in the House.
All right. So just to make clear, because there are some people who maybe have not thought about this, if you live on the island in Puerto Rico, you cannot vote for president.
Exactly. And that's pretty offensive for the veterans and the military service personnel, because they're out there. They put their lives in peril. They defend our liberties, they defend our way of life, they defend our democracy, yet they cannot choose or participate in the election of the commander-in-chief. At the same time, they don't have a voice and a vote in Congress. When Congress makes decisions like, for example, funding the armed services themselves in which they serve.
So finally, Congressman, what do you think that service means to the young in Puerto Rico?
So part of it is tradition. Part of it is really being proud of our American citizenship and being proud of the fact that Puerto Rico is part of the U.S., it's a territory of the U.S., and wanting to defend our nation, wanting to defend our way of life, our system of government. So that's that. There's that too. There are, I bet, in some cases, economic motivations. The Army is a great place to, you know, also develop a career. Army or U.S. Air Force or all the armed forces. Obviously, there's a risk factor that you have to realize and acknowledge from day one when you join the armed forces. But there's no question that serving in the armed forces is an honorable thing to do, as well as a fair way of moving up in life.
Congressman Pierluisi, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and speaking to us from San Juan.
It's been a pleasure.
Congressman Pedro Pierluisi is Puerto Rico's resident commissioner. He's a Democrat and a member of the pro-statehood New Progressive Party. And we want to know what you think, listeners. Do you think Puerto Rican veterans would be better off if the island became a state? Tweet us at LatinoUSA and tell us. Now, we travel to a different era of service, back to 1950.
On Sunday, June 25th, communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. Free nations must be on their guard, more than ever before, against this kind of sneak attack.
That was U.S. President Harry Truman's address before deploying the U.S. Army to the Korean Peninsula.
a regiment of nearly 4,000 Puerto Rican soldiers spearheaded the American advance. They were nicknamed the Borinqueneers, from the Taíno word for Puerto Rico, Borinquen. And as you can tell from this 1951 newsreel, the Borinqueneers played a vital role in the first year of the war.
As part of their indoctrination course, Puerto Rican soldiers are taught English at Camp Tortuguero. The island citizens are making a further contribution to the cause of liberty and freedom. These men are preparing to take their places in the ranks of America's fighting men. For months, their comrades have been in the front lines in Korea. General MacArthur has praised the Puerto Rican 65th Regiment for its valor during the bitter Korean campaign.
My name is Edwin Aviles. I'm 84 years old. I was in Korea September of 1950.
Edwin Aviles was a member of the Borinqueneers.
They were the 65th Infantry newcomers. Most being Puerto Rican, there was some kind of a language barrier between, to communicate, but eventually we were able to do what we had to do.
He remembers one of the 65th's first missions, to rescue a Marine division surrounded by enemy troops.
We came after the enemy. We opened up a gap big enough so that the 1st Marine Division was able to withdraw with equipment and everything else. We were all scared, but at the same time, the blood is running in a way that you have to do the best that you can. And we were able to withdraw the whole battalion. I was a very fortunate man because I never got either wounded. I was shot at many times, but for some reason I was safe.
Edwin managed to stay safe, but his best friend in the unit wasn't so lucky.
To my best friend, who died in Korea shortly after I left Korea, he died about 3 weeks later in a counteroffensive that the Chinese had. He never made it over here, and I dedicate that day that we had the Congressional Medal approved on his name, and his name is Josue Cortez from Ponce, Puerto Rico.
It was the valor and self-sacrifice like this that earned the Borinqueneers the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor bestowed by Congress. They received the medal in June of 2014.
Segregation set them apart from their fellow soldiers, but their courage made them legendary. They earned thousands of medals for their service in Korea. Today, we're going to add to those accolades by awarding these soldiers one of the country's highest civilian honors, the Congressional Gold Medal.
President Barack Obama at the ceremony where they received the medal.
Only a handful of military units have ever received this award, and only one other Hispanic American has received this award, Roberto Clemente. That's pretty good company. So this is a proud day for the Borinqueneers and their families.
The Borinqueneers achieved a lot during the Korean War, but it took almost 60 years and a lot of congressional lobbying by veterans and influential Latinos in order for them to get their recognition. At 95, veteran Jose Colon says his feelings about the gold medal are bittersweet.
And I feel sad because there's so many that if the medal had been awarded when General MacArthur made the comments about the Borinqueneers in Korea. All those people, all those soldiers that not with us now could have enjoyed having the medal in the 65th.
Colon wishes his comrades in arms could have seen this day. The Borinqueneers served in Korea at the time the U.S. Army was being desegregated. Today, more than 30% of the U.S. Armed Forces are men and women of color, and 11% of active U.S. Army members are Latinos. To find out more about the Borinqueneers, visit our website, latinousa.org.
Una de
And to end our show now, a little bit of news. Last week, the Department of Defense announced that the U.S. military will now allow and actively recruit undocumented immigrants who are part of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program. For some undocumented youth, this means the opportunity to finally serve the country they consider their home, like high school senior Yael Julian Calderon Esquivel. For this week's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, he tells us how serving in the U.S. Army will fulfill his childhood dream.
My name is Yael Julian Calderon Esquivel. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. I attend Omaha Central High School, and I'm a DACA recipient. For what I wanted to do in a career after high school is to serve in the military. And so when I heard that President Barack Obama gave the executive order of giving work permits to teenagers like me, it was like a golden ticket. Ever since I was 8 years old, I watched like my first military movie called Pearl Harbor. And even though like it, I mean, it's not like Hollywood brainwashed me, but it kind of did a little bit. And I told my dad after done watching it, I was like, I think I know what I want to do when I grow up. And he just kind of smiled at me and he told me that, you know, whatever I wanted to do, go for it. The reason why I want to serve here in the American Army is because mainly I've spent the majority of my life, I've grown up here in this country. And as I was growing up, I just got used to living here. The education that was provided for me, the as well as many other things, I felt like this was my new home now. And serving the Army here in the United States is kind of like me paying back or me saying thank you for all the opportunities that were given to me. And that is why I want to serve here in the American Army.
Words of wisdom from high school senior Yael Julian Calderon Esquivel. And mis queridos y queridas, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Michael Garofalo and Jasmine Belcher at StoryCorps, as well as our music consultant and StoryCorps senior producer, Nadia Raymond. We'd also like to thank the folks at the Borinqueniers Congressional Gold Medal Alliance. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Funding for Latino USA's coverage of a culture of health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Some random guy came up to me yesterday and complimented me on my mustache. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR.